months into Germany. Do you that would have been after the first of the year into the spring?
Yes.
And you crossed?
We crossed the first town I think we were in was called Worms, Germany.
Mm-hmm. Know it. Mm-hmm.
And that's right on the Rhine River.
Right.
And then we were just there a short time, and then we moved into Mannheim, Germany,
mm-hmm.
which is and set up a shop there, which was we had pretty good sized buildings to work in there.
Mm-hmm. And now the Rhine, it was the Allies that were securing the bridges over
right.
the Rhine. So by the time you got there, those bridges were secure.
They were secure, and you could go across. Yeah.
Okay. And I've often wondered when you are in the middle of a situation like that, and there's just all this constant movement of troops, and what was your impression? Was it organized? Was
it's pretty organized, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was it sort of amazing in a way?
Well, before we got into Germany, there a lot of the bigger towns, or most of the bigger towns where there was any industry or manufacturing going on of mm-hmm. you know, the Germans had a lot of equipment too. They were a very well mechanized army.
Mm-hmm.
And before we got into Germany, the planes from Great Britain would go over every morning. You'd see waves and waves of them, and they were bombing all of this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these towns were completely destroyed.
Mm.
And we even had to clear ways in these larger cities to move our equipment into where we wanted to go.
Okay. Well, what happened to the German civilians? Were they still there?
They were still there. They, you know, they made do the best they could, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever you needed to take over a building, you took it over.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved out.
Okay. And I was thinking, if you were going to major in engineering, you must have a mind that would appreciate organization, efficiency, and things like
yeah.
that. And did you could see, of course, I suppose, how the Germans operated and some of their equipment, et cetera. What was your impression of them as a fighting force?
Well, I thought, you know, we were pretty well impressed with the equipment that they were able to manufacture.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the first jet airplanes that I ever saw, I saw in Germany.
Oh, really?
Before the Americans even had any.
Mm-hmm.
They were manufacturing airplanes, jet airplanes, and as we moved in, we'd see a lot of them in certain areas that had been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
But they were jet airplanes.
Okay.
And I'd never seen one before.
Hmm. Did you get any souvenirs along the way?
Oh, yeah. I brought home a pistol and four or five swords and a few things like that.
That were just on...
Well, it didn't take them off of anybody.
Right.
I just acquired them as...
Okay. Okay. And at that time, you could bring things like that home.
Well, you could bring some.
Mm-hmm.
You had to declare it when you got ready to come home. That
mm-hmm.
that came after the war, but...
Okay. And from basic training on and in various places in your unit, did you make good friends? And
sure.
And did
sure.
you keep up with them after the war?
Sure. Some of them, yeah.
Okay. And were they from all over the United
States? All over the United States.
Yeah. And was that a good experience?
It was excellent. I enjoy it. I spent a year in Germany after the war in the Army of Occupation.
Oh, okay. Well, we need to get to that then. Because I don't think that I've talked to anyone who stayed. Most people came home either right before or right after the war.
No, I was late getting over there.
Mm-hmm.
And when the war ended,
mm-hmm.
in right at the end of May of 1945,
mm-hmm.
the war ended, the guys that had the opportunity to come home were the ones that had been in the service the longest and
okay.
had been overseas the longest. A lot of them had been through the Africa campaign, you know, and
mm-hmm.
so they had a lot more time overseas than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so we they developed a point system, and the ones that had the most points came home first.
Okay.
And the rest of us had to stay in the Army of Occupation until our turn came up.
Mm-hmm. So, and in the, where were you when?
The war ended?
Yeah.
Our company was in Augsburg, Germany.
All right.
In our shop, we had a shop set up there, which Augsburg is north of Munich,
mm-hmm.
north and a little bit west, I guess. It was on the Autobahn Highway that used to, was one of the main highways north and south through Germany, or mm-hmm. West Germany.
Was that an impressive highway?
It was. It was a big, just like our big freeways.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it was still, you know, they bombed out most of the overpasses and bridges as the Germans moved back. Well, they destroyed a lot of that, and then the Americans destroyed some too. So it had to be cleared out so it could be used, but mm-hmm. it was. After the war, they did use it quite a bit.
Okay, and how would they clear it out? We had heavy equipment
heavy
over there?
Heavy equipment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you then heard immediately that the war in Europe was over.
The war ended, which we were glad to hear that, mm-hmm. and then everybody immediately started wondering when they were going to get to go home. Well, after this point system was developed, we had an idea then, that,
mm-hmm.
and most of them in our outfit were fairly, well, we all went over the same time, so we pretty much stayed in, not in exactly in the same companies, but we stayed in the area mm-hmm. in different places.
Mm-hmm. And were you doing the same kind of work, or that would have been different?
It changed because it wasn't, it was more, well, I'll tell you, what happened to me was I didn't do the same work very long because when the war ended, the colonel of the Ordnance Group Headquarters in the 7th Army,
mm-hmm.
the group headquarters was in charge of all the ordnance companies in the 7th Army,
mm-hmm.
and there was a colonel that was ahead of that, and our company, the 445th Ordnance Company, was one of the companies under his command.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided that since some of the guys were going home and others weren't, that the morale was going to be a problem with the guys that had to stay for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, what can we do to help keep the morale up? Because we're going to be involved more just in policing the area, mm-hmm. not in doing the things that we'd been doing on replacing vehicles and all that, but it's mostly just, you know, just policing the area and making sure that the area remains secure,
mm-hmm.
for the not only ourselves but for the people. So he says we need something, and he says, why don't we start a dance orchestra?
Okay.
In headquarters, and then just have this group be able to go around different places and play for dances mm-hmm. and each one of the companies in the area. So I was called in because I had on my service record somewhere that I played the piano.
Oh my gosh.
So they called me in and uh-huh. interviewed me and wanted to know if I could play the piano in this band. And I says, well, I don't think I could play that kind of music. I play more classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they said, do you play anything else? And I said, well, I played in a little jazz band in high school, the bass fiddle. Well, we need a bass fiddle in this band. So I was called in to help start this band.
Oh. And how many were in the band, and where'd you get the instruments? And
well, we were there, ended up with about 15. It was a big band, because mm-hmm. that was a big band area.
Right.
Glenn Miller and all the big bands, you know, mm-hmm. that was the kind of music that we liked.
Okay.
So I was transferred from the 445th into the 52nd Ordnance Group
mm-hmm.
headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in a little town called Pforzheim, Germany.
Okay. Not familiar with that.
Not, but it was in the area, but it was a different place than our company was, where it was located. And we got, they finally ended up with 5 saxophones, 3 trumpets, 2 trombones, piano player, drums, bass fiddle, and anyway, about 15 guys.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were pretty good musicians. I wasn't that great, but I could play the bass fiddle, which isn't all that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to just search around and you know, they'd find the instruments in music stores someplace.
Okay.
And so they just managed to get instruments for everybody and a start of a music to play.
Mm-hmm.
And we started, and after about 3 or 4 weeks we started going different places. Somebody would call in, a company would call in, want to know if we could play for a dance. The colonel got us a bus to travel in and a driver.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent from that time, and that was in June of 1945,
mm-hmm.
until April of 1946, playing in that band.
All over Germany?
All over West Germany. West Germany.
Well, what a neat experience.
Not East Germany, but West
Germany.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we'd go north. One time we were clear up to Kassel, Germany, which is the northern part,
mm-hmm.
and all the way south to Munich, and mm-hmm. played over the Armed Force Radio Network in Heidelberg. And
did the band have a name? It was just named for the
52nd Ordnance Group Headquarters Band.
Okay. And you would practice every day?
Colonel says your duties are to take care of this entertainment and play in this band, and he says you're relieved of guard duty, KP duty, everything else. You just do this.
Hmm. So that was a different role that you played.
Yeah,
in
that's right.
So as you traveled around, what was your impression of the occupation?
Well, I felt that these poor people were having a very difficult time, because they were just living in a lot of places in the rubble.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And in the beginning, at the end of the war, there was a order that you couldn't fraternize with the German the German people.
Mm-hmm.
But that gradually changed. It didn't take very long, because if you're going to have a dance someplace,
right.
Who are you going to dance with?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I thought maybe there were enough women.
No, there wasn't enough nurses and wax. They would kind of take care of the dances for the officers' club, but that
mm-hmm.
that wasn't taking care of the ones for the
right.
common, you know, ordinary soldiers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they lifted that fraternization fairly fast, and so the guys, you know, the girls would come in and
mm-hmm.
when they had the dances and have a great time.
And do you think that it met the colonel's purpose to help the morale?
Sure, I think it did.
Okay. Right.
And I think it helped to the morale between the German people and the American army too.
Mm-hmm. And did you got to see then a lot of different historic places.
Yeah.
I suppose most of them were sort of destroyed by.
Well, in Heidelberg, they never dropped a bomb in Heidelberg.
Okay.
It was declared an open city because of all the large buildings and castles in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Old buildings,
mm-hmm.
churches, and so they declared that an open city, and the Americans did not bomb.
Okay.
There.
Okay.
Like Kassel, Germany, which is up north, it was completely destroyed.
Right. I think that yesterday Cecil Davis was there.
Yeah.
I think he talked about that too.
And that's one of the places where I said they had to bulldoze the streets out so where you could get down the streets.
Mm-hmm.
It was that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we were located, when we stayed there for a while, and we were located in buildings out on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was quite an experience.
Oh, I'm sure it was. Did and you were definitely aware that we were pulling out, and soldiers and equipment and things
sure.
like that were going home?
Sure.
Okay.
And some of them were being pulled out to go to the Pacific.
Okay. Did you ever think that you might?
I thought I might. Yeah. You know, the ones that hadn't been over as long. We figured we'd we'd be the first ones called to go to the Pacific, but mm-hmm. I don't know how the orders were made to decide who was going to go and who wouldn't.
Do you remember where you were when you heard that we dropped the bomb?
Yeah, we were in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
See, that happened in, I believe, August of 1940.
Yeah, I think that
45.
August 7th and 9th or something like that.
But that would have been about 2 months after the war ended in Europe. The,
mm-hmm.
Then they dropped that bomb and ended the war in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So not too many
had to go from
the European theater to the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, I'm sure the government figured that they weren't going to send them because they knew they were dropping the bomb.
Well,
do you remember what you thought or what people said when we dropped the bomb?
Well, it was just, you know, unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't believe it. Or it was something, we had no inkling that it was going to happen.
Right.
Until it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I wasn't even aware that they were working on anything like that,
mm-hmm.
trying to develop it.
Mm-hmm.
See, the Germans did have buzz bombs.
Right.
Kind of, you know, like our missiles today,
mm-hmm.
they would shoot those into Great Britain, and a lot of them hit.
Oh, that's during the Battle of Britain?
Those were kind of a rocket-type bomb that they shot across the channel into
mm-hmm.
into the London and different places.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any specific people, any specific anecdote or story that you, when you talk about your war experience, that you always tell?
Well, I was close to the place where General Patton was involved in that wreck, and as a result of that, they took him to a hospital and he died
mm-hmm.
from that wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And that was towards the end of the war, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we were in Mannheim at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he was just getting ready to go, or he'd been told to go home, I guess. Yeah.
But I remember that. Our shop at one time had one of the cars that Hermann Göring, which was a field marshal in German Army,
mm-hmm.
German Air Force,
mm-hmm.
and we had one of his vehicles in our shop.
Hmm.
So that was you know, we knew that.
Mm-hmm.
We knew it was his, and we knew that it was in our shop at that time.
Mm-hmm. And were you aware of the concentration camps?
Oh, yeah. In fact, we were very close to Dachau.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were aware of that.
Well, you had a wide experience, really. Mm-hmm.
Couldn't hardly avoid it.
No, that's true. So you were there until when, did you say? 46?
I got home in April of 1946.
Okay.
It was almost a year after the war ended
mm-hmm.
in Europe.
And by that time, you had earned sufficient points?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
I'd spent a year and a half at that time in overseas and a year in the United States. I was in the Army before I went overseas. I was in the service about a year here.
Okay.
And then a year and a half over there, so 2.5 years total.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows on here that we went through two different campaigns, the one called the Rhineland
mm-hmm.
campaign and one of the Battle of Central Europe.
Okay.
And so we got a battle star for each one of those.
Okay.
And I was listed as automotive mechanic, third echelon, and a rifle expert.
But you never really used your rifle.
Not really. No.
Did you hunt growing up? Is that why you were so good?
Well, I tell you, I had an uncle that was in the Marines in World War I, and he taught me how to shoot a high-powered rifle.
Okay. And was he was in the Army then?
No, he was in the Marine Corps.
Marine, and your dad was in the Navy.
Navy.
So you really had a military tradition in your family.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he would take me over to Dodge City and And he was really a gun enthusiast, you know. He collected guns and he worked on them and he loaded ammunition for them, and he would was always shooting in, you know, as a sport.
Mm-hmm.
after when I knew him. So he would take me once in a while with him and show me how to adjust the sling on a rifle and that kind of thing. And
mm-hmm.
So I was pretty good with a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not bragging or anything.
No.
But out of the 500 guys in the battalion, I ended up with a top score.
Well, I think you have. You could be bragging a little bit. Did your uncle have any war stories that he told about World War One?
Yeah, when he was in the Marine, he was in the Marine Corps in World War One. He was younger than my dad by about 8 years, and he lied about his age to get in because he joined the Marines when he was about 16 or 17 years old, and he didn't get overseas.
Mm-hmm.
He landed in, at that time they had a detachment down in Cuba.
Oh.
So he was down there, and while he was in Cuba, he, of course, he was an expert rifleman himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at one time picked as one of the riflemen to be on the, I think there was a, was there a, Olympics back in that time.
Oh, I'm sure there was.
But he was picked as one of the guys to be on the rifle team that went to the Olympics. But
really?
He didn't make it because of the flu epidemic. He got in the flu epidemic.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so he got sick, very sick. Didn't die, but he got sick enough that he couldn't make that.
Mm-hmm. What was his first name?
Homer Mitchell.
Homer Mitchell. And what was your father's name?
Walter Mitchell.
Walter Mitchell. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize that we had people down in Cuba, I guess.
Yeah, there was. That's where he was located.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason. I don't know why.
And is that where he got the flu?
I think so.
Okay. Because that's the flu where a lot of people died.
Yeah, in fact, Dad, for several months, thought that Uncle Homer had died. Died in the flu epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody, I don't know, he ran across somebody that was in the same area, and he asked about his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, he says, I think he died in that flu epidemic. And Dad didn't find out for two or three or four months later that he was okay.
Yeah. It shows you the communication.
Yeah.
That wasn't there, I guess. Yeah.
But he made it.
When you then headed home, did you have an idea of what you would do when you got home?
Sure.
Go to college?
Go to college, finish my education.
And did you do that?
That's what I did.
And where did you go?
University of Kansas.
Okay, engineering?
Engineering. I've got a degree in mechanical engineering.
Mm-hmm. And were you on the GI Bill? Did you
Yes.
use that?
Yes.
And could you maybe describe what that was?
Well, the GI Bill was one of the better programs that the United States government has ever come up with.
Mm-hmm.
Because it enabled anybody that, you know, that wanted to or had the effort to do so to go to college and complete their education and get a job.
And were you paid, was your tuition and...
Tuition and books were all paid.
Okay.
And then I was allowed, I think it was $50 a month on my board and room.
Okay.
To pay.
And were there a lot of other?
There was a lot of them that came back to the university, and some of them by that time were married and had families.
Mm-hmm.
And they at the University of Kansas, they put up kind of like trailer houses in different areas, and these families would move in and stay there while they were going to school until they finished college.
Okay. All right. And when did you then get your degree?
I got my degree, and I graduated with the class of 1950.
Okay. Was there any thought about the Korean?
In fact, I almost got called into the Korean War.
Really?
Yes.
the draft was still going?
No, no, I made the mistake of joining the inactive reserves when I got out of the service.
Okay.
I was a staff sergeant at the time, and as I was going, being separated from the Army in 1946, I was passing down the line, and this, I remember this one gal sitting there at a typewriter. She says, "Well, do you want to join the reserves?" Well, I says, "What'll that do for me?" Well, she says, "For one thing, if you ever get called back," says, "probably won't, but you can retain your rank, what you have now, to start out with instead of starting all over again."
That sounded like a good deal.
So I says, "Yeah, well, I'd just as well do that." So I signed up for the reserve. She says, "Since you've already had 2.5 years active duty, you won't have to be in the active reserve, because if the active reserves had to have meetings like once a month and training and
is that the same thing as the National Guard?
No.
No, that's different. Okay.
National Guard is a different organization.
All right, okay.
But this was what's called the Army Reserve Program.
Mm-hmm. But inactive, you just were there.
Inactive, I was allowed to be in the reserves, but not how I didn't have to train. You know, go to training or summer camps or anything like that.
And then came Korea.
I was attached to an anti-aircraft company in, I believe it was Topeka, Kansas, on an inactive basis. So I signed up for 3 years in that. So that took me to 1949. 1949, I was still at the University of Kansas and about to get married. And I thought, well, you know, I just will keep that in force. So I signed up for another 3 years in the reserves. Well, got home, and when I graduated, it was difficult to find a job as an engineer anyplace. So at that time, my wife and I got married August 13th of 1949. And I finished up then in the fall semester. We both went back to Lawrence and stayed that fall and to finish up my degree.
Right.
And then since I didn't have any place to go to work at that particular time, I went out to the farm and started farming again.
And then?
And then at that time the Korean War started. And I didn't think too much about it. I was supposed to keep the Army and advise where I was located and what my address was. And I hadn't done that very well. And I guess it was we got married in 49. And our first child was on the way and was born in October of 1950. And I had about 300 acres of sugar beets planted, almost ready to harvest. And I got a letter that had been forwarded to me from my mother, who had lived in Fort Collins, Colorado, stating that I had to report to Fort Riley to take a physical to go to Korea. So I went to Fort Riley, took my physical, came back. About a week later, I got a special delivery letter from the Army saying that I was to report to Fort Lewis, Washington to go overseas.
Oh, dear.
To Korea. My gosh, what am I going to do now? Had all these sugar beets to harvest. And my wife was about to have a baby. And I went to see an attorney in Scott City, and he says, "I don't know what you can do." He says, "The first thing you need to do is get off of these orders." He says, "Why don't you go down to Garden City and see our representative, Cliff Hope?"
Okay.
So I did. I went to Garden City and I sat down and talked to him and told him my situation. And he says, "Well, it's pretty important that you get that crop harvested." And he says, "I can get you off of these orders for 2 or 3 months till you can get that done. But he says, I don't know what'll happen after that. He says, I can't get you out of the reserves.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. He got me off of those orders. I didn't have to go to Korea. And then every time when that short deferment was over, my wife had had the baby. I'd turned 25 years old at the time. And so then my second term was over, and they sent me a notice that I could be discharged. So I was discharged from the